Today's Keisho is on case 51 in the Book of Serenity, Feon's Boat or Land. In mundane truth, how many people have been enlightened? In Buddhist truth, how many people have been deluded? If they suddenly become one, can you then define delusion or enlightenment? Feon asked Elder Zhao, did you come by boat or by land? Zhao said, by boat. Feon said, where is the boat? Zhao said, the boat is on the river. After Zhao had withdrawn, Feon turned and asked a monk standing by, tell me, did that monk just now have eyes or not? Verse, water doesn't wash water. Gold isn't changed for gold. Find a horse without knowing its color. Enjoy the lute without the strings. Tying knots, drawing trigrams, when there are such things, completely lost is the true pure mind of original human. Just go over the case itself. Feon asked Elder Zhao. Elder Zhao is a senior monk who's come to Feon's temple. And he said to him, how did you get here? Did you come by boat or did you come by land? Zhao said, by boat. Feon said, where is the boat? Zhao said, the boat is on the river. Now this is a Zen exchange, right? Known in Japanese as a mando. In other words, a monk has come to Feon's temple and Feon wants to know something about the monk's condition of awareness. So he asks him, he doesn't say, come in, you know, have some tea, let's talk about your koan training. He doesn't say, let's discuss our previous reincarnations or something like that. He just gives him an ordinary question to see if his Dharma eye is open. So he says, did you come by boat or land? This is a statement that's full of that could be a koan in itself. Did you come by boat or land? If you just were in deep mushin and you meditated on that, you sat with that for many, many days, it would in itself produce a great insight. It looks like an ordinary question, but it's loaded with implications about the nature of reality. So Zhao says, I came by boat. Okay. And then Feon asks him a question. He says, where is the boat? So this is like, this could be a Zen question. Where is the boat? You know, is it nowhere? Is it in your mind? Is it, is it in the past? Does it no longer exist? You know, so there's a lot of possible, that too could be a koan. Where is it? Where is it? And Zhao says, the boat's on the river. See, again, could be very profound a statement, could be utterly a trivial statement. After Zhao had withdrawn, so with Zhao leaves and Feon turns to the monk standing next to him, he says, tell me, did that monk have eyes or not? Doesn't mean does he have like eyes. It means, is his Dharma eye open or not? What do you think? Is his Dharma eye open or not? So this is a very interesting koan about the interpenetration of awakening and ordinary consciousness, you could say. We are now at day 5 of our August session. And it's, I must say, I've had a wonderful time, and I hope you have. And it's been like a magical environment for us to train. People in the modern world live at such a great distance from nature. You know? It's really sad. Because we're the product of billions of years of evolution. You know, we evolved to be at home in the world, and nature is our home. The world is our true home. And yet, we human beings are, because we have a capacity to imagine ourselves as separate from the world, because we have a neurological capacity to do this, we have constructed a cultural framework that's constantly moving us farther and farther from our home, which is the world. We get so far from that world which produced us, but every once in a while it becomes possible to sort of be reminded of the beauty and the sheer majesty of this natural world, even in its most simple. You know, when we started the sesshin on day one of sesshin, it was like 90 degrees, maybe hotter. And humidity was usual New Jersey humidity, 105%. And we were, trudging around. And I think many people felt sometime around day two that this was going to be difficult because it's so hot. Now, the truth is that if you're really in samadhi and you enter mushin, you should be able to be cool in the hottest weather. And it's easy to do. We'd spent a number of days on the cushion just sweating it out, or at least I have. And I know so well that feeling of just being covered with sweat in the cushion and being blissfully happy. Just like a potato baking in the oven, just happily cooking, baking in the oven of the world. And it's a wonderful experience to be hot. It's a wonderful experience. You know, when January is here, everybody's going to look back fondly on August and say, oh, boy, if you're here at sesshin, we're going to have to walk from here to the bathroom in the dormitories, and it's going to be like, oh, man, it was so great in August. We could just go in our bare feet and t-shirts to the dorm, And everybody, as soon as you get out in the cold, you'll be clenching here. For every muscle, and you think, oh man, summer, where's summer? But, only a few days ago we were all, thinking, oh, winter can't come soon enough. This is just human nature. But, amazingly, the weather turned cold when it rained the other day, and today again it just poured. And if somebody had built a huge air conditioner and turned it on, they couldn't have done a better job, right? I mean, this morning, it was just, last night and this morning, just so cool and refreshing. It's just beautiful. And then this morning's rain, right? I mean, I personally love rain. And I think rain is really good for sitting. I just love, I spent it. 10 years of my life doing sesshins in the rain, just about. In Seattle, it rains like this a lot. And it was easily possible for us to go do a whole sesshin and never see the sun. Just raining when you get there, it's raining in the middle, it's raining at the end. I mean, easily. And I have to tell you, I love it. I sat there this morning and I just thought, oh, this is so beautiful. Just so beautiful. And it's easy in the modern world not to appreciate something like the rain, because you know, we live in air-conditioned apartments and houses. And when it's hot outside, we just go inside and we fire up the air conditioner. And we walk around the house, and it could be October. It could be October in the house. You know, could be January. Could be March. Right? But think of our ancestors, not so long ago, and actually people all over the world still. You know, not just the 2 days like the first 2 days of Sesshin, but all summer. You know, the temperature climbs. You get up in the morning, and it's hot as a firecracker. And you go through. You have to do your job in the heat. You come home. You're tired. You lie in bed, and it's 100 degrees in your bedroom. When something like a day like today comes, you know, people in times not so long ago would have just felt like, you know, this is a miracle, a miracle. The rains don't just come from the sky, it's like these rains come from heaven itself. They're so beautiful, so cool, and refreshing. Right? And so I think all of us were prepared to greet this cool weather with real joy in our hearts. That partly because we had just been through such hot weather. We tasted the heat, you know, and the fatigue, the heat tends to make people tired. And you feel that fatigue, and then it just lifts, and your heart soars in this cool, beautiful weather. This is just a simple example of what life can be like if you walk the path of Zen. You know, this is like an element of Zen 101. It's like, you know, just weather. And all over the country, or at least all over New Jersey right now, there are people who are in a funk. And they're sitting around going, oh man, another weekend of cold, rainy weather. Yeah. And I was going to go to the beach. Like, oh man. And you know, that's the modern lifestyle, right? You know, and our ancestors would have, you know, gotten down on their knees and thanked heaven for a day like today. It's like, how joyous this is. You know? I think, the bigger perspective. See, the person who's in a funk because it wanted to go to the beach, this is a different universe. You know, that person's in a world of, I would say, personally, and I mean, we're all there some of the time, right? And probably all of us there too much of the time. It's like a small self thinking. That's a small self orientation. So it's like, how can I have my plans, I have my likes and my dislikes, how can I maximize my pleasures and minimize my discomfort? Right? And that's welcome to the modern world. And so the air conditioner's on, and you're looking out the window, and it's raining, and you think, what a bummer. You know, what a bummer. No beach this weekend. Meanwhile, you know, all the birds are so happy. All the insects are all drinking out of little tiny leaves, you know, little droplets of water. Everything is nourished and brought to life by this precious rain. And we're not the only creatures who feel the cool as refreshing. You know, a few weeks ago we had a cold snap also from Canada. The air came down out of Canada. And my cat, I have a cat named Isidore. And Isidore is not a fan of the heat, you know. So if when it's a, I must say that actually we don't have central air. And when I come home, Isidore is like usually comatose. Right? He's just like, it's like literally somebody ran over him, right? He's just like flat on the ground. It's like all the air has been let out of this cat, you know. Sometimes his tongue is actually hanging out of his mouth. He's so hot. You know. It's just like, They can barely get up and drag himself over to eat. And as soon as he eats, he's like, quick, you know, back to sleep. And it's so funny, he just really hates to eat. So we had this cold snap one, you know, a couple weeks ago. And Isidore just, you know, he was just like hysterical, you know, with happiness. He, you know, he ran out and he had to get out the door and he was screaming his head off. And when I left, he can never just go out the door, right? It has to be like he's busting out of jail. So, you know, when I open the door, it's just like he's like, he shoots out, like, hank, you know, being released from prison. And then he sort of scampers around and he goes up, we have a fir tree, and he goes up and he tears at the bark with his claws, you know, and he's sort of skipping around the yard. He's so happy, right? But this real joy, you know, real joy. When we come to Sesshin, we have the opportunity to simplify our lives in so many ways. And, you know, it's elementary simplification, right? I mean, that you don't have a lot of clothes, you don't have to worry about your appearance, you don't have to worry about having interesting subjects for conversation with your friends, because you're not supposed to talk. And so there's very little social interaction, schedule is rather determined, you know, so at any particular hour you know where you're going to be. And the important things are getting through the next sit, and dealing with your pain, and getting enough sleep, and eating, right? And this is the formula, I think, for a really happy life. Believe it or not, you know. Now, you know, we all have to live in the world, and the world is a little more complicated than that. But much of the complication in the world is artificial, I think. It doesn't make people particularly happy, and it doesn't make them particularly good, you know, I would say. So all the complications in life are really not necessarily an enhancement, and in a way we can't always deal with life without some of those complications. But it is possible to come to Sesshin and sort of remind yourself of what life can be like. When we eat lunch, we eat a simple meal. Somebody, I won't mind my saying this, I'm sure this person won't mind, but somebody in Dokusan said, I think the food should be plainer because it's enticing us to be too attached to our food. And I was so flattered, I wanted to kiss that person right on the forehead. It was just such a kind thing to say because actually, the food is not that great. It just tastes really good because everybody's hungry. It's true, you know. Lasagna is delicious, right? But there's nothing to it. It's just noodles, spaghetti sauce, you know, some vegetables, beans, and it's, you know, if you were sitting in front of the tube, right? And you were, going over some papers from work or something, and you had your, you got a call in on your phone, you know, and so you're watching the television with one eye and you're answering the phone with the other, and you're shoveling it in, you know. You just think, oh, that was okay, you know. But when we simplify like this, you know, when you're sitting in the heat, and sweating, and you're tired, and you're hungry, and you go in to sit down, and you know, just a bowl of rice is so good. It's like this rice. I love rice. It's so good. And you know, basically, just some green beans, two or three spices, and potatoes. It's like this is heaven. Right? This is like a 5-star restaurant. Because you're prepared to be, you know, in the presence of life. And in its simplicity, it's magnificent, right? And it takes us a lot of preparation to be in the presence of life, because we have this capacity to imagine so many things. You know, humans have an interesting capacity to imagine something other than what's right and what's really here. You know, people develop this capacity gradually over time, and it begins to run away with them. It begins to, you know, control their lives, even when they're little kids. So, for example, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but when I was a kid, when I was a little boy, I began to be very afraid of being in the dark, you know, because I thought monsters were going to get me, right? And I would lie in bed and I would just sit there. I remember I went to a movie called Sleeping Beauty. Sleeping Beauty was a Disney movie. And there, I was quite young, and there was an evil witch in there. I can't remember her name, but she was very menacing, you know. I mean, she was supposed to be. She was very menacing and frightening. And she made lightning occur and things like that. And storm clouds would come from behind her, and I remember my father had built me a model rocket ship, and it was over by the window, and it went in the dark. That rocket ship looked like the evil queen from the Disney movie, who had a crown on her head. And I remember I would, you know, wake up at night and just look over there, and I would be absolutely terrified. You know, that evil witch was in my room. And your parents can come in and say, oh, there's, look, turn on the light, it's just a rocket ship, you know, it's not an evil witch. And, oh, I know, but then they go away and you get this nagging feeling that there's something under the bed, right, you know? And, you know, it's going to grab you and drag you under there. And then you could say, well, then what will do? You know, you'll just be under the bed, you know? But, you know, humans have this capacity to imagine the world other than other than it really is, and it's delightful in certain ways, but we begin to lose control of it at an early age. I would say that's one of the first moments where it becomes apparent that, you know, we lose control of our imaginative faculty. It begins to terrorize us, right? And this goes on all our lives. And you know, the human condition is that in the modern world, people are really have given free play to the imagination. You know, in other cultures at other times, people haven't done that. You know, for better or worse, they had other values. So at certain times in Indian history and in Chinese history, the natural world was very important. So, you know, when people in the Tang Dynasty thought of a good life, they actually thought of simple life. You know, they thought the best thing I could have would be a house out in the country, and it would be a simple house. You know, it wouldn't be a McMansion. And I would be able to have a few friends and my family there, and I could go walking in the hills, and I wouldn't have to work. You know, this was like the goal of Chinese people for hundreds and hundreds of years, to just basically be free and just enjoy the natural world. That was, you know, that was considered the highest fulfillment in life. So other cultures at other times have had very different value systems. But our culture has just said, imagination is everything. Let it go, let it loose. And they've let it explode across the world. And it creates this perpetual transformation of everything. So you know, the natural world tends to disappear under a kind of a surface of fantasies, right? You can just see it disappear, and our fantasies unroll across the landscape. And who knows where it will end? But every once in a while, it becomes possible for humans to rediscover this ancient way of life. In fact, The Buddha actually called his teaching, he never called it Buddhism, actually. He called it the ancient path, among other things. He also called it Dharma, which could be understood as the way of nature, as the natural way, the order of things, another way to think about it. But it's possible, even in our rather crazy world, to come here and experience simplicity, and the whole universe is opened up. It takes us, because our civilization is so crazy, it takes us a long time to calm down and become less distracted. So sesshin is indispensable if you want to get anywhere in Zen practice. I often say in other contexts, in the Saturday Sits, for example, that you can't really say you're practicing Zen if you're not practicing sesshin. Because it's just not possible for human beings in the modern world, or even in ancient times, as a matter of fact, to free themselves from their illusions without serious effort. And so it takes at least a day or two just to become sort of semi-sane. We our minds are just like a buzzing beehive of anxieties, projections, fears, and so on. And when we come to sesshin, your first day is usually just taken up just gradually getting rid of, sort of like pulling vines off an old house, you know. That's sort of like first day. It's like pulling the vines off of a building that's lost sight of, an old building somewhere. And so first day is just pulling off the vines, and then second day is sort of saying goodbye to the small self, you know. Instead of saying, well, I'm not going to move my legs even though I want to. I'm tired and I have a cold, but I'm not going to get more sleep. I'm going to get up at 4:30 and I'm going to come in and sit down on the cushion, and so on and so on. You know? And so at some, you know, that's usually kind of a fight, a little bit of a fight, because we may not want to necessarily say goodbye to the small self so easily. But by day three, or day four, you begin to have a little bit of a change. And the more you do this, the more the change. You know, so simplicity is something we have to learn, appreciate. We don't necessarily appreciate it right away because our way of life is rather, in my opinion, rather distorting. There are people who come to the introductory Zen classes who come thinking they might be interested in Zen. And I think they're like I was, you know, they're thinking I'm going to go, now here's the mystic circles, and I want you to sit in this circle and light, hold these candles in your hand, you know, and say blah, 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 you know, or, you know, something like that. I want you to study these sacred books and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And none of it. Just sit down, be quiet, you know, don't move. I'll get back to you in an hour, you know. And a lot of people don't know what to do with that. You know? They just don't. And they say, oh, that was wonderful, thank you, and they never come back. But every once in a while you meet somebody who says, gee, that was interesting. And that is, there's something there. And usually people can't, they don't say it like that. They just come back. Right? I mean, I don't know, there was something about Zen practice when I started doing it that it just felt so liberating. It was like this day. It was like the cold weather coming in yesterday. You know, it was just so liberating. If Buddhism has any flavor, it would be the flavor, I think, of freedom. You know, this beautiful freedom. And there's freedom from and there's freedom to, right? I mean, Zen is a freedom, maybe you could say, there's freedom from and freedom with. You know, this is freedom with everything. Right? I mean, really not afraid, because we are constantly saying, we're constantly embracing the moment as it arises. You know, and as you do this, instead of picking and choosing and saying yes or no, as you embrace the moment as it arises, you just feel more and more liberated. It's such a strange thing. And so all the devices of the world that we have produced to sort of screen out unpleasantness turn out to be rather unnecessary after all. So anyway, this is I hope you've had a good experience here. This is like a machine. Sesshin is like a machine for enlightenment. Right? You just come, go through the process, and usually, generally speaking, people feel a little bit better at the end of the experience. If that's your situation, you need to, and especially if this is maybe a early sesshin for you, you need to decide if you want to practice Zen or not. If you want to practice Zen, it's not enough, even though I said earlier, you can't practice Zen without coming to sesshin. It's also the case that just coming to sesshin isn't enough. It's not good enough. It won't really help. I think the world of Zen is full of people who don't practice regularly but go to sesshin. There are a number of temples in the area, and meditation centers of various kinds, and people sometimes go there like once a year. I have a friend who's a professor, and he goes to one of these places once a year. I don't think he practices very much, actually. And whenever I talk to him about his experience, every time I talk to him, I see him, you know, every fall I'll see him and I'll say, well, did you go to your meditation retreat? It's a Vipassana retreat. And he'll say, yes, I did. And I say, how did it go? He said, oh, a lot of pain after. Mm. And it's because of the way he lives his daily life. You know, when I was, for a while I was sitting with Eido Roshi, his group up in central New York, and I met this guy who, after the sesshin we were talking, he said, yeah, I come up here every year to, he called it Buddha camp. Like boot camp? Buddha camp. And it was like he just came up there to get his ass kicked, you know? It was like, I'm going to go up there and they're going to, kick my ass and I'll be a better man for it, you know? Really. And it was torture for him. You know, I said, how did it go? I said, oh, a lot of pain, you know, eat vegetarian food, you know, get up early, that'll sort of shape him up for the next year. And actually, that's rather common, you know, to tell you the truth. In the Asian world, East Asian world, people often go to sesshin as a way of, sort of shaping themselves up, they'll go to a sesshin to sort of like do penance for something, maybe they've done something wrong, they'll go to sesshin. And that's okay, that's a decent motive, but it doesn't help if you don't change your life, So if you want to do Zen, coming to sesshin as often as you can, and we all have worldly matters that prevent us from, being here all the time. But as often as you can, you try to come to sesshin, and then the other thing is to make practice, daily practice or quite regular practice, a part of your life. And this is really indispensable, because basically sesshin is not good enough. Sesshin doesn't really work if you're not building Zen into your life. You know, and generally speaking, human beings need a community to do this. That is, people need a community of practice. Most people are just too, let's be honest about it, too weak to wake up without the help of other people. I benefited enormously from practicing with other people. When I began to sit with the Seattle Zen Center on a regular basis, I began to make real progress. And I would go to sesshin and say, gee, I wonder why I'm not getting anywhere with this darn sesshin. Things will happen if you're practicing very regularly, and then you come to sesshin as well. Things will happen. And we have a structure that makes all of this possible. Right? We have sitting at the university, basically 5 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week. That's plenty of practice, right? And we have other groups in the area that meet regularly. And if you're in an area where you don't have a group, you can try to form one and get people to practice with you. The point is not to convert anybody to anything. That's not the agenda. I can't imagine what that would mean. But it is to have a community with whom you can pursue awakening. And the people tend to keep themselves up and keep themselves going. So, in Seattle we had a carpool down to the Zen Center, and at one time I didn't have a car, so I was just dependent on others for my ride. And eventually I got an old Volkswagen Beetle, and it had a beige body and a blue door. I would give, then I could participate fully in the carpool because I had a car. But when I didn't have a car, I used to go down usually with the carpool. They'd come by our house and pick me up. And, some mornings I would just get up and I would be so darn tired. And I would think, maybe I just won't be out there today. And then I'd think, they're all out there. So I'd get my ass out of bed and wash my face and have some yogurt and go out and wait for the car. And then I'd go down. I was always so happy afterward that I'd done it. And so having people you can practice with is really very important. And then it's really important to try as much as possible, and it's very difficult, to try to simplify your life, try to lead a different kind of life. It's important to try to not get too entangled with non-essentials. Another thing, it's very important to cultivate kindness in your interactions with other people. It's something we all have to work at, right? Is being kind and trying to help other people, being helpful to others. It took me a long time to connect this with Zen practice because my motives were so selfish, mine personally, not talking about anybody else's. I wanted to be a great enlightened being, and I also wanted to get out of my psychological unhappiness. And I didn't ever think about helping other people. It literally never crossed my mind. Right? If I could have gotten to enlightenment faster by pushing other people out of the way, I probably would have done it. Really, I was not a very nice person in my opinion. Or let me put it another way, I was a very fearful and selfish person. It gradually dawned on me that other people could use my help. And that even though it was very inconvenient, it was somehow very satisfying to help other people. And that was really a discovery. Nobody in my upbringing, my parents, nobody had ever said, you could be helpful to other people. You could be nice to other people. That was never on the schedule of important things. Success was important. Personal happiness, whatever makes you happy. And nobody ever said, what about other people? What about me? It just took me a long time to discover that that was important. But it's part of Zen practice. When in the tea ceremony, is a ritual where the tea is made, and then it's handed to the person who's going to drink the tea. But the ritual is the person who's going to drink the tea never drinks it first. You always offer it to the person sitting next to you, to your left. And only if they decline, and they always do, but only if they do decline, do you drink it. See, this is like a basic lesson of Zen. It's others before self. See, others before self. If that's not your attitude, your practice is defective. And it may not be possible, if you're like me 30 years ago, may not be possible to put that into action too often. But it should be on the schedule of things you need to do, is to begin to be more sensitive to other people. And this is quite important for practice. You can't enter deep samadhi and feel connected with the world very easily if you make a mental habit of being at war with the world, or if you make a mental habit of being uneasy with the world all the time. So it might be important to simplify your life and try to be attentive to the needs of people around you. And basically, one other thing, I'm not trying to sound preachy, but this koan is about connections between life and practice. It's very important to associate with people who are edifying. That means it's not good to associate with people who are self-destructive, destructive of others, and so on. So basically you need to associate with people who have good hearts and who are kindly and well disposed to noble efforts. And if you know people who are cynical, bitter, angry, and so on, and you can try to help them, but it's probably not good to spend too much time in their company. And that seems rather harsh, but you should you should help everybody who needs your help. But your associations are part of your environment. You know, and so hanging around people who have serious problems, who are destructive or self-destructive and so on, is not necessarily good for you. This is like an ecology of mind, an ecology of life. It doesn't mean, I'm not saying don't deal with people who have problems or shun people who need help, but just you need to have healthy interactions with the physical world, with social world, and other people. And if you're involved in unhealthy, destructive actions, in relationships, or that's something you need to recognize and deal with, you know, so that you can have a clean heart as you go through your life, you know, and you can be true to the best part of yourself. If you're locked into certain kinds of social relationships that don't permit that, then those are destructive. And you should do something about it. So, anyway, this is the last day of session, and it's been a great joy to practice with you. And the crickets are in the grass, and rain may or may not continue to fall. We have these precious hours left, and we're here in this beautiful simplicity. And if you are thinking about life change, it's not necessary to quit your job and go live in Tibet. That would be a mistake, you know, probably, for most people. All that's needed is try to carve out a time in your life for regular practice and session when you can do it. And you can disguise the limit in terms of what you can do if you just do that. And then that requires sacrifice, let's face it. You know, you could have been doing a lot of other things besides session, but you came here. And if you feel good about life, please remember that. You know, you could have gone to Aruba, you could have gone to Paris, but you came to Lanoka Harbor and you sat next to Somehow it's very satisfying, isn't it? Very beautiful. So thank you very much.